Welcome back to Studio A on Worldwide KFUO. I'm Roland Lettner. It's my honor to host this world-exclusive first interview with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about his Vietnam memoir, Duk, A Reporter's Love for a Wounded People. If you missed the first hour, it's going to be available by way of download as an MP3 at the Studio A page at KFUO.org. If you missed it, download it, listen to it next week. It's well worthy of your time. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is a Lutheran lay theologian. He's an author of several books and an international correspondent and war correspondent with over 50 years of experience in that vocation. Uwe, let's get right back into this. The international flavor that you were talking about before we went to the break, the international flavor of the Vietnam War, for the most part, has been forgotten. An interesting aspect, and please talk about the Germans. Yes, folks, the Germans who fought in Vietnam as members of the French Foreign Legion.
Yeah, they were Germans or Austrians, that's true. Yes, they were, and quite a number of them stayed behind afterwards when they left the Foreign Legion. The reason why there were so many Germans was that the French, at the end of World War II, treated German POWs in France very, very badly, starved them, and made them work very hard in the mines. And then started placed next to the POW camps, Foreign Legion camps. They were also full of Germans, and these soldiers were well-fed and were merry, and they had beautiful women, and they did everything in India you wanted as a soldier. And they said, all you need to do if you want to be fed well, come over here. And of course, then, you know, they did. Many of them did, especially those who had no place to go home to, who had lost their families in the air wars or in the occupation, during the occupation of the eastern parts of Germany that later became part of Poland, the Soviet Union, or East Germany for that matter. So they joined the Foreign Legion. Also, they included disreputable characters who might have been roughened as soldiers and done some pretty nasty stuff in World War II. But again, they would be incorporated in the Foreign Legion. They were, of course, good combatants. And then sent out to Vietnam, to Indochina, among other things. They made up the majority, as you said, of the Foreign Legion forces there and were probably the leading combatants in Southeast Asia. The North Vietnamese also had their German Foreign Legionnaires. Quite a number of Germans deserted from the Foreign Legion and joined the Viet Minh. About 2,000 altogether. In fact, two of them were adopted by Ho Chi Minh. One name comes to mind. His name was Schröder, and his Vietnamese name was Ho Chi Long. And so their main function was to advise the Viet Minh in weapons and in tactics, strategy, and also try to lure German legionnaires from the French side over to the communist side. And these guys were then ultimately released, those who survived, into East Germany. So that was the other side of the story. But there was a strong contingent, and very strangely, the German was quite amazingly well-spoken because of that, because the German units got on very well with the Vietnamese, the civilian population. And so the Vietnamese from the countryside were all congregated around South Vietnamese, those French Foreign Legion camps. And one of the protagonists in my book recounts his fondness for things German and spoke German too because of this, and especially new German songs. I had an interpreter, I'm calling him Lan in my book, who was a trombonist and spoke perfect German, having served both as a trumpeter in a German French Foreign Legion battalion band, and trombonist rather, and also having served as an interpreter. And he then served as an interpreter for German correspondence during the Second Vietnam War.
And Uwe, that short rendering is just a small representation of the humanity that you put into this memoir, and aspects of that humanity that may have been forgotten if you hadn't written this book. How did those people, those experiences, change you as a man? And especially, how did that entire war and all of the experiences you write about affect your faith as a Lutheran?
I can't be a hypocrite. I went to Vietnam as a foolish hedonist who loved good food, wine, women, and song, which, by the way, is, of course, a Lutheran thing. And Luther did coin that phrase. But I was brought up a Lutheran by my grandmother. I was properly catechized by her, and I knew Lutheran liturgy. I don't think I ever went to church in Vietnam. However, in combat situations, and there were many I was in, I sang in my head the Kyrie Eleison so often. And I also prayed the Lord's Prayer, and then, of course, this wonderful Psalm 51, "Do not take thy Holy Spirit from me." You know, here I was the hedonist, and at the same time, when the story that there are no atheists in the trenches is, of course, absolutely true. And when one held the hands of dying soldiers, dying GIs, and heard them cry always first to their mothers and then to God, that affected me. It did affect me. I know that it affected me so that years later, decades later, I studied theology and got a master's degree and a PhD in Lutheran theology and sociology of religion. And that I did, well, if you study theology, one of the compulsory courses is called CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education, and I did this in St. Cloud, Minnesota, in a VA hospital, where I formed therapy and pastoral care groups, three of them for Vietnam veterans. So it did affect me, and I know in retrospect it affected me greatly. At the time, I was like St. Augustine, you know, I enjoyed, I was quite carnal.
One thing that comes to mind that people may remember from Vietnam was the phrase, peace with honor. As you, Uwe, as you experienced that war and you watched it end and you witnessed the horror that followed, was there such a thing as a peace with honor for the people of South Vietnam, for your friend, Duc?
No. I think it was totally dishonorable. I'm sorry. And by that, please understand that I do not fault the American GIs. I think they've done this. They themselves were their lives squandered by what I think was a very dishonorable. You know, again, let's double back. When I came on leave and I went to America, after my time in Vietnam, came to America again and heard people badmouth the GIs and calling them the Vietnam veterans and calling them, as was famously said in Vietnam, in American, in New York, cocktail parties, my least favorite minorities, Vietnam veterans. You could see that something dishonorable was happening simply because the soldiers were, a nation owned its own soldiers because the war interfered with a sense of, I think, what they considered good and free life, Woodstock, etc. And it interfered with their perception of responsible big power behavior. The myth was sent out that the Vietnamese were a bunch of crooked allies, that they were corrupt, they were wimps, they were weak, and they squandered American money and all that sort of thing. When, in fact, what many of us saw a totally different Vietnam. Now, the peace was was concluded because America had lost the nerve for this war. After the badly reported or badly analyzed Tet Offensive in 1968, actually the South Vietnamese and the Americans won, which should have been treated as a definitive defeat for the communists, who lost more than half their men in this combat, and their entire infrastructure gone. And then when Walter Cronkite came out, and contrary to what we who had been in this combat had seen, announced that this war was unwinnable and we should now negotiate an honorable peace, which of course, as we knew, would definitely be a dishonorable peace. That was the end of that. And then LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, said to her, "I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America." And then they negotiated a deal which allowed 250,000 North Vietnamese soldiers ultimately to stay in South Vietnam, a flagrant violation of the Geneva Peace Accords of 1954. And then ultimately, so then the Americans withdrew, everybody was happy in 1973, with the North Vietnamese still there, and then finally Congress voted against supplying the South Vietnamese with war weapons. So they were betrayed and lost. And to this day, which is what I find so unfathomable, to this day, you cannot get American media to report, for example, about the presence in their very midst of South Vietnamese. Thousands and thousands of South Vietnamese are here in my neighborhood, where I live, 200,000 in Westminster Garden Grove. Hundreds, thousands of these people were tortured, had severe head injuries, and have such desperate personality flaws that they are barely functional. And there is a Harvard study out, Harvard, all places, pointing to this, and it's not being covered by the American press. Mm-hmm. This I find so troubling, Roland, that I really wonder whether the democracy that we've known that have come to love will last. It cannot last unless people come to their senses and don't stop lying to themselves and do what has to be done. If God places you somewhere as a superpower and a protective power, you don't just say, "Well, I've been with you long enough. No, to hell with it, and I'm going home. Bye bye." And then continue treating the Vietnam veterans, those who fought there and suffered there, like subspecies of Americans not deserving honor and respect. It's amazing. I think there is a character flaw here, and I think it is a character flaw fed by, I think, irresponsible journalism.
Perhaps you have a Vietnam is fading for the most part from the active memory of the American public because the suffering that you have to confront as part of that narrative. You know, my generation, the baby boomers, really have no concept of real suffering and perhaps want nothing to do with a past that holds much of it.
Who can blame you? I mean, you know, if you're spoiled, you're spoiled. That I can't blame people for being well off, okay, and enjoying their good times. So I think that's a given and that's a good right. What is troublesome is not, Roland, that you have not experienced before us. What is troublesome is that your generation is not being told what has happened and is being deprived of the facts say about South Vietnam, and therefore might not be able to really judge what will happen in an analogous situation, like, for example, Afghanistan and other parts of the world, where again, you know, nobody seems to give a moment's thought to what will happen in Afghanistan after 2014. I'd like to add something here because I find this rather significant. When, you know, the Germans have a rather large contingent by European standards, the third largest after the United States and Britain in Afghanistan. And one of their lead soldiers died a few days ago in combat. And I saw the German KSK, they're called the equivalent of your Delta Force, or your Navy SEALs. When he died, Chancellor Merkel flew over and voiced and assured also the Afghans that the Germans will not necessarily leave in 2014. And we have now 4,000 people still left there, but there will be at least 800. And what is not being reported, because nobody reads German or French or other papers in this country anymore, not even your own papers do that, what's reported is that, for example, the Germans now are trying to figure out what to do with the approximately 60,000 Afghans whose lives will be in danger because they've worked for the Germans in Afghanistan, the German forces and the police advisors, and they will be in danger if the Taliban take over. How are you going to protect them? Now, that's only one aspect. The other aspect is, here you are with your huge feminist movement, which I think is the most bogus movement I can think of. Check NOW's website. Do they shed a moment's thought on what will happen to Afghan women when they fall back into Islamist hands. Will we have beheadings and stonings Fridays after church again? Will they be forbidden to drive again? Will they be forbidden to study, to learn, to go to school, to do anything? All of this, we knew 10 years, 15 years ago that this was taking place in Afghanistan. And even now, headed on their website, now it's nothing. Now all American feminism is all about is how to kill more babies. But it's not how to protect women, sisters, other women from being mistreated in case the Americans, and well, not in case, but after the Americans have moved out. Then, you know, take a phrase from the Vietnam War, let's negotiate peace with honor. So are you going to say negotiate peace with honor with a totalitarian force? This is the most absurd, stupid slogan that a politically correct, self-defeating culture can cook up. A peace with honor can never be accomplished couldn't be accomplished with the Nazis, it couldn't be accomplished with the communists. And how are you going to accomplish a peace with honor with Taliban? So you're going to negotiate them that for the first 5 years of the next Taliban rules, you can only execute half as many presumed adulterers as after church on Friday, and maybe more of them get beheaded rather than stoned to death, so that would be a concession on their part. Or maybe women should be allowed to learn half the alphabet, not the full alphabet, and maybe they would be allowed to drive a car, but only for 3 miles or something like that. I mean, how are you going to negotiate something like that when you're dealing with an enemy who is totally the exact opposite of what a civilized Western democracy should stand for? And if feminism in this country is only confined to the right to slaughter your own children, then feminism is evil. I would like to see, I would take them much more seriously if they really started out campaigning for the lives and safety of their sister women in Afghanistan and Iraq and in other places, where we know horrible things are going to happen after the NATO withdrawal in 2000.
Tell me about your writing process. Often you'll hear writers that are interviewed, and when they take on a memoir or they take on some difficult subject or issue, often they credit the writing process for changing them in some personal way. Does writing a book like this really change a person, Uwe?
Of course it does. Well, first of all, let's use this particular case. In this particular case, I am regurgitating, or better still, I'm reviving memories that had lain dormant. And it changes me in a sense because, well, it has changed me in a sense, because it had it reminded me of how I felt in combat and when I came out of combat. It was so bad. I leaked of death and dirt and blood, and it was so bad that I felt so dirty I couldn't touch my wife, and my wife thought I had left her or I had a huge affair with somebody else, and none of that was the case. I mean, I felt so desperately impure. And that feeling, even the smells, Roland, have come, while I was writing this book, have come back into my nostrils. In the middle of the night, I woke up smelling putrefaction of rotting corpses around me. So it has changed me, obviously. It also has reminded me of a very important factor that we all, whom are telling this, have a calling from God to our secular vocations. And the calling does not end until we go, we cross the divide, until we're dead. So therefore, I found it imperative to tell this thing and to pronounce this and go around saying this, like giving lectures about it, because I believe this is my vocation. As was writing about Vietnam and about other things, was my vocation. And that ends when I'm dead. But until then, I hopefully will be able to pursue, you know, passing on this message.
As our time is short, and as promised to the listeners, where and how can they get a copy of Duk, A Reporter's Love for Wounded People?
Well, the book is already available, that is the preliminary privately printed edition, at Simon Netto, SIMON-NETTO.org. As of the end of this month, or early June, it will be out on Amazon.com, and ultimately also as a Kindle edition, as you can read it in an e-book, Amazon.com. The name is now Duk, A Reporter's Love for the Wounded People of Vietnam. I linked the subtitle to make sure that Vietnam is in there. And I'm currently, as we're talking, I see sort of correspondence coming in from Amazon as we're completing the layout of this. And as I said, it's going to be available there. But if you're anxious to have it tomorrow morning or within a couple of days, go to that Simon-Netto.org website, and you can order it from there.
It covers things both delightful and dreadful. It's a remarkable read. It's about 300 pages. It's one of the books that, there are very few books that I've ever picked up that I've read in the same day, start to finish. And this is one of probably five in my lifetime. And I enjoyed it tremendously. And I appreciate the grace you've shown me in giving me so much time this afternoon to go over the book with you. And I wish you great success with it. I would love to see this put in the hand of every high school student in the United States.
Yeah, it should be there, yes, and catechism classes and the adult classes and, you know, people like that. It's not an in-your-face Christian book, but it has a Christian message, and that is that we are responsible and we have a calling. And journalists too, especially journalists, have a calling. I'm quoting in it from the journalist prayer book, which was incredibly Lutheran. It was quite prominent back in the 60s. Unfortunately, it's no longer in every journalist's hand.
Our guest in this segment of Studio A has been Dr. Uwe Simonetto. He was the religious affairs editor for the United Press International, an international journalist with over 50 years of experience in that vocation. He also served as a war correspondent in Vietnam and director of the League of Faithful Masks and the Center for Lutheran Theology and Public Life, which is based in a beautiful, beautiful part of the country, Capistrano Beach, California. Once again, Uwe, where is Duk, A Reporter's Love for Wounded People, available? And put in a quick plug for the center as well. We don't want to neglect that.
Yes. Well, there has been a change. I'm glad you asked me about it. I am no longer the director. I'm just now the founder. There's a new guy called Dr. Jeffrey Marison, who is a professor at Concord University, will be taking over the daily running of the Center for Lutheran Theology and League of Faithful Mass. But I'll still be on the board, and I'll still be listed as the founder, and I'm still working for it, and be working for lecturing. But the daily operation has been placed in the hands of a much, much younger man. It was high time. But it's in Capistrano Beach. But the website is, again, this is for this book specifically, Simon, S-I-E-M-O-N, dash, Netto, N-E-T-O, .org. Then you just follow the instructions.
Thanks again. Godspeed your travels to France. I envy you for that trip. And thank you for your friendship. All the best with this book.
Thanks, Roland. Thanks, and we'll talk soon.